I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Michael Eric Dyson is a prolific writer, and his new book, Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America, is written in the form of a series of letters to Black Americans who have been victims of violence at the hands of the police and white supremacists, from Emmett Till to George Floyd. He begins with a heartbroken letter to Elijah McClain, a 23-year-old massage therapist and self-described introvert who lived in Aurora, Colorado. He was 5'6", weighed 140 pounds, and had asthma. It was the summer of 2019 when someone called 911 because they said McClain looked, quote, sketchy. When the police arrived, they restrained him in a chokehold. He cried out he couldn't breathe, asked why he was being attacked, even asked for forgiveness, and eventually died on his way to the hospital. We asked Michael Eric Dyson to talk about this fraught racial moment we are in and whether we can ever address the legacy of our original sin as a country. Michael Eric Dyson joining us by Skype. And Michael, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's been a while, and I'm glad to be back.
Well, we're happy to have you back as well, and we have a lot to talk about. But I do want to begin with the letter, just the first couple of paragraphs of the letter that you wrote to Elijah McClain, which frankly just broke my heart.
Yes, yes. Dear Elijah McClain, I write to you out of profound grief. It is not easy to watch the Black bodies pile up in the streets and in our imaginations as we reckon with a racial catastrophe that has haunted this nation from its first breath. When I saw the video of your fatal encounter with the police, it literally made me, a grown Black man from the rough streets of Detroit, teeming with mayhem and murders, weep almost uncontrollably. I suppose it was your sweet demeanor. I suppose it was your palpable innocence. I suppose it was the fact that a video was even posted. It told me from the start that the outcome wasn't going to be good, that you wouldn't survive, that your death would be another death that would happen as if it hadn't happened at all. God, I thought, I fairly prayed, even begged, not this sweet young man, not this beautiful soul, not this humble spirit, not him. He cannot have posed a threat to anybody, and surely not to cops armed with guns and batons and tasers. All he had was a coat and a mask and a gentle bearing that enveloped his vulnerable soul as he was trying to get by on his own terms. Mm.
And again, Michael Eric Dyson reading from the very beginning of the book. And I'm embarrassed to say that I had to Google Elijah McClain because I couldn't remember who he was.
Well, look, the reason I began the book, you need not be embarrassed at all. Most people hadn't really heard of him. And Elijah McClain's story didn't surface until after George Floyd's death, where Breonna Taylor's death was highlighted. Rayshard Brooks immediately afterward began to shine a brighter light. Ahmaud Arbery's being gunned down in Georgia, not by police, but by white vigilantes. And then the death of Elijah McClain last year in Aurora, Colorado, right outside of Denver, came to light again. So many of us had not heard about it, or when we did, it was only glancingly. And now, because of the reckoning that the nation claims to have undertaken, Elijah McClain's case has come to the fore once again.
Well, and it does raise a whole host of questions. And you write about his innocence, and everything I read about him seemed like such a shy, as self-described, introverted young man. And yet he was not safe on the streets of Aurora.
That's exactly right. And this underscores, no matter what Black people do, no matter how we behave, no matter how we present, there seems to be no defense against the penetrating, relentless, lethal attention of law enforcement to Black bodies, that if we have our hands up, we get killed. If we have our hands down, we get killed. If we agree with the police and obey their very commands, we seem to suffer the same fate as if we were repudiating the police's authority and finding ourselves in range of their baton or their bullets. And it's heartbreaking because this young man exhibited what we might call respectability politics. In other words, showing that I'm a good person. I'm not a threat. He even suggested that he understood why they were doing what they were doing. He went and talked to them. He spoke to them. He asked them to respect his space as an introvert. And yet they not only neglected to respect his space, they invaded it with lethal passion, and they knocked him out twice. They put him in chokeholds and, you know, rendered him unconscious twice before the EMT experts came and administered ketamine to him. And then he went into shock, and a week later, after being taken to the hospital, he died. It is tragic all the way around.
Absolutely. You watched a lot of these films, including the death, the killing of George Floyd, and others as well. You describe them almost like snuff films, that when you watch them, and it seemed like you watched them frame by frame in order to try to understand what was happening at this moment, or even moment by moment. What were people thinking? What were they doing?
Right, exactly right. No, I do think they're snuff films. This is part of the pornography of death in the cinema of black mortality. And, you know, there's a macabre sense of watching them, maybe the re-traumatizing that black America has to undergo every time one of these films emerges. And many people, you know, decide that they can't watch them. And I understand why.
Sure.
But I think if the black people who died didn't have a choice in their death, the least I can do is to undertake the effort to watch frame by frame, to deconstruct, to demythologize what they are dealing with in order to explain it to the world so that perhaps, hopefully, it won't happen to another body, to see what they were doing, what they were grappling with, what the police were saying, the interactions between the two, to try to dismiss the narrative of so many, especially white brothers and sisters. Well, you must have done something. You must have acted out of order. You must have misbehaved. Now, that does two things. First of all, it ignores how when white folk misbehave, they don't ever seem usually to receive, at least routinely, the same sorts of lethal consequences that black people do. We see white people with machetes chasing police. We see white young men being arrested who wrestle themselves free, chase the policeman away, who has a gun in his holster, and then get in his car to commandeer his vehicle to escape. So that's number one. Number two, though, it suggests to us that there is nothing possible that black people can do. It's not what we do. It's who we are. So it's not an act. It's not a behavior. It's an existence that we can never erase, because we can never erase ourselves.
George Floyd, the death of George Floyd, the killing of George Floyd was the impetus for this book. And I think a lot of people, I certainly watched that video, as frightening and horrifying as it was. And I think it's something about Derek Chauvin, the police officer who has his knee on Floyd's neck, the kind of nonchalance about it, and the fact that he was being filmed and yet somehow wasn't asking him his own self, what am I doing here? I am killing somebody.
Right, exactly. Because he wasn't killing someone. He was killing a non-entity. We have thought previous to this that we should say Black Lives Matter. What we should say even before that is Black Lives Exist. Hmm. Because the non-existence of blackness, despite our philosophical argument that we are here, seems to be a fact empirically verified by the assault of police on bodies that never make a difference, that never seem to be accounted for. So here we are, a philosophical conundrum in the minds of, collectively, a police force that wills our non-being, that wants to evaporate us, to disappear us. And so our non-existence is the predicate of their jobs and vocations, it seems. Now, that may seem extreme and, you know, highfalutin, but at the end of the day, how else can we explain the fact that no matter what black people do, no matter what we say, no matter how we behave, no matter how we agree, no matter how we attempt to de-escalate, which is the job of the police person, we seem to get murdered or killed. And Derek Chauvin, there with a kind of nonchalant, sadistic impulse, hand in pocket, as uncurious about George Floyd's existence as he is about the nature of black holes in the universe. He has no understanding of or concern with this black man's body, despite the fact that the man is literally telling him, I can't breathe. Hmm. But when you don't exist, the assertion of a state of being is a curiosity to be dismissed. And he dismissed that curiosity as he dismissed George Floyd's life beneath his knee, his mortally bruised column being further asphyxiated by this man's indifference and, by the way, the complicity of the other cops, another white cop, a black cop, and an Asian cop, proving to us diversity without equitable ends means nothing. Diversity without real justice is a masquerade and a blackface, so to speak, for real prejudice, real bigotry, and real, I think, maniacal inattention to the real equity that should prevail. So, yeah, Derek Chauvin didn't care, and think about this, Marty. He must have known that Eric Garner died similarly. He must have known that caused outrage and people to flow into the streets. It didn't make a difference. And the fact that he knew that 17-year-old Darnella Frazier was recording him, he knew that he would have most likely qualified immunity so that the Constitution guarantees public servants, including police people, the exemption, if you will, from being held accountable personally for even a murder that they might commit in the name of the state. So therefore, all of our hands are bloody, not just Mr. Chauvin's knee.
And we're almost up in a break here, but on that same day, Christian Cooper, a black man, bird watcher, was in Central Park. Amy Cooper was in the park with her dog. She accused him of threatening her in some way. And that happened on the same day, a very similar but also very different kind of racial incident.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you think about the so-called Karening of white women who call the police on black men, usually, or black people, white women who feel deputized to carry out the will of the state or to impose rules and restrictions or amplify them or echo them as they exist or to make them up on the spot, to improvise a sort of authoritarian restriction of black mobility. And she got caught up short this day because, first of all, the black man Karened her.
He said, Karened her.
Right? He flipped the tables on her and said, no, can you put your dog on a leash? He did what white women usually do, some white women who are in those positions usually end up doing. So I think she was offended by that. And furthermore, he wasn't your stereotypical black man. This man had a degree from Harvard. He was an ornithologist, I guess, an amateur bird watcher of some note, and has since written a dramatic comic about his encounter that day, a graphic novel, a graphic comic, so to speak, to address that situation. So she was brought up short, but it did underscore.
Well, you know what, Michael, only because they're playing my song, I got to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I do want to do another reading as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Michael Eric Dyson about his new book. It's called Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. Each chapter written to a victim of violence, a black victim of violence in this country. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, Michael, speaking of Karens, if I can put it that way, as a white woman myself, can you read another section from your book? And this is on page 6.
Yes. My fellow Americans, I beg of you, first consider this. Do you realize how much faith it takes for me and those like me to write My Fellow Americans? Do you realize how much energy it takes to summon the will to say those words? Do you realize how weary I am, how weary we are, millions of black folk in this country? And right from the start, it's a troubled we, a complicated we, a disputed we of being denied recognition as Americans, or even as human beings? Do you know that so many black folk are still full of love for the nation that so often treats us so poorly? We are used to hearing presidents say, "my fellow Americans," a phrase composed of a pronoun, adjective, and noun, to suggest the bond we share as citizens. Grammar is one thing, citizenship an entirely different affair. Has the sentiment ever really been true for black folk? Do we really live in the same country as white folk? Do we see the same things? Do we experience the same realities? Is our nation's motto fully realized, e pluribus unum, out of many, one?
And again, Michael Eric Dyson reading from his new book, Long Time Coming. You also say later in this book, talking about black people, yourself, we just want to take a nap. And you white people, you clean up the mess you made. But obviously that hasn't happened, and I'm not sure it's going to.
Right. Yeah. Black folk are suffering collectively from a sleep apnea. We haven't been able to take a nap for 401 years, it seems. We're amazed and glad that many white folk are now woke. And we want to say, hey, can we take a nap right now? But, you know, unfortunately and tragically, we can't trust the people driving the car to stay in the lane. So we have to stay awake to make sure that in their wokeness, the car is not derailed. Excuse the fanciful metaphor, but the truth is...
No, go ahead.
The truth is that it is extremely difficult for black people to trust that the investment white people make in being awake will continue to go on. Will they continue to set the alarm clock? Because people who are awake do have to go to sleep. Sure. But will they reawaken? That's the real question. And we know that there are peaks and valleys, and this is a peak, although it's now subsided. And white people may have moved on to something else, as we are all want to do. But can we do the real work to make sure during the unsexy times when there is not high visibility on radio or television, we pay attention to the things we need to do to make this reckoning real?
Let me ask you, do you think, though, that the 4 years of President Trump and the way that he has handled racial issues, whether it's Charlottesville or Confederate flags or Confederate statues, has kind of paradoxically spurred progress on some of these racial issues, even gotten white people to be more woke because he says the quiet stuff out loud?
He does say the quiet stuff out loud. This is a conversation I was having with Dr. James Peterson, my friend, and you all know. Yes, you know him there.
I do.
Great man. And we have this conversation just recently, and we were talking about the fact that the enormity of Donald Trump's truculence, his comical sometimes and indefensible, support of white nationalism has led almost ineluctably to a reckoning with race, to making people go, wait a minute, it can't be. It is that bad. Oh, we thought that this couldn't be possible. He would never do this. Many white people who thought, I think some of you black people are kind of exaggerating what the deal is. Maybe some of you Jewish brothers and sisters are not really in tuned with the currents of anti-Semitism. We've tamped down on that. Oh, lo and behold, we've got the tiki torches, and we've got Donald Trump saying they're good and bad people on both sides of the divide, the neo-fascists and the neo-Nazis and the Antifa and those who oppose them. So, yeah, I think it woke up a whole bunch of people. It made black people realize that we can never be satisfied or comfortable. And it made a lot of white people go, dang, stuff that people of color were telling us is really true. And we've got to pay strict attention to what's going on.
You write a chapter to Emmett Till. He, of course, the 14-year-old boy from Chicago who was visiting Mississippi. He got brutally murdered for, you know, allegedly flirting or whistling at a white woman. This is August 28th, 1955. Are we a different, a better country today?
As to whether we are different and better, I think we are different by degree, to be certain. And we are better by many leagues. And yet, we find that Ahmaud Arbery is hunted down and killed by vigilantes in Georgia in our day, in our year. And so though things have undeniably changed, though that is not as routine as it used to be, it is still plentiful enough to suggest to us that we haven't reckoned in a fundamentally decisive fashion with the racial animus that continues to survive in our culture, that persists. And the nation is better to be certain. But, you know, as to the degree to which we are willing to go to make certain that things really get a lot better, it's left to be questioned. You know, we can't even support affirmative action. Are we going to support reparations? Are we going to do the real structural work that is necessary to get done in this nation to confront our past? You know, that question remains to be answered.
But I mean, in part, many of the books that you've written are trying to address this question, which is how do we deal with this racial legacy of slavery and the country's founding? But how do we talk to each other about race? How do we bridge these divides? I mean, sometimes the divide is Republican or Democrat or urban versus rural. But if it's racial, how do we address, how do we talk to each other? And I think, Michael, I talked with you when Obama was president and we thought, oh, finally, we're going to have this wonderful conversation about race. And we haven't had it yet.
No, we haven't had it. And Obama didn't lead it because he didn't want to be ghettoized. And he was the conversation on race. Obama's black body with his thin shoulders bore the weight of a history that we had not yet reconciled to our own understanding of how America should be. So he was the walking, peripatetic conversation on race, so to speak. Where he went, the conversation went. So he didn't have to have it. He was it. And we refused to deal with it, though. And the refusal to deal with it explicitly, you know, and I'm sorry, but I'm an old Baptist preacher, you know, and there's a story in the New Testament, I believe, when you put out the demons and you don't put anything in their place, seven worse demons than the ones you put out are going to come back and inhabit your house. And I'm afraid that because we tried to deal with the demon of race to a degree with Obama, but not really effectively, and we didn't put anything in its place to really compensate for its presence, seven worse in the form of Donald Trump came into existence, into the house of American democracy, and it has wrecked and ruined so much of it. So what do? First of all, we got to be honest. You know, America is really interesting, isn't it? That's a non-committal phrase.
I was going to say, yeah, interesting. yes, it is.
here we are, obsessed with history on the one hand. Can't get enough of books of George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln or the Founding Fathers or the Declaration of Independence or Alexander Hamilton or Aaron Burr. But boy, when it comes to race, hey, haven't we had a book on that in the last 10 years? Jiminy Cricket, what's going on? Why don't you people get over it? Wait a minute. You're reenacting the Civil War every year there in Pennsylvania. You're looking at Gettysburg and missing the lesson of Lincoln with its bloody armaments exposed to the greater will of emancipation. And he lost his life as a vicious compromise. And yet we replay that, but we don't understand the lessons at play there. As Jay-Z said, you paid all that tuition and you still lack class. So we lack insight. We lack understanding. We lack the will to really grapple with this. So let's be honest. We don't want to know about that history, but the moment we get curious about it, the moment we say, you know what, let's find out what the heck is going on, I think we make huge strides. And then secondly, though, I'm not for cancel culture.
No, you're not. And I do want to get to that. Right.
But the thing is, I don't want to cut people off. If people are ignorant, let's acknowledge it. If people just got woke, you know, I don't want to say to white people, God dang, what were you doing for the last, I don't know, 400 years maybe? Did you miss the lesson in slavery or Jim Crow or black water fountains or Brown versus Board of Education or Du Bois or Martin Luther King Jr. or Ida B. Wells Burnett? I don't want to do all that. You're awake now. You're awake now. What can you do? Read, study, reflect, be humble. White people challenge white people. Ask each other to step up to the bar, belly up to the bar, and be more conscientious about how we reckon with race in our own times. And that means grappling with some uncomfortable realities and truths that many white people would rather not confront.
And let me just quickly reintroduce you. I do want to talk about police reform. That's Michael Eric Dyson. And we're talking about his new book. I think you've written something like 30 books. I had to check that last night just to make sure. He's got a new one. It's called Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us Phone number 1-888-477-9499. Many of the Black victims in this book that you are writing letters to were killed at the hands of the police. What does police reform look like to you?
Well, you know, I know it's very controversial. I know President Obama and Jim Clyburn, two politicians who have extraordinary pedigree and records of achievement, think that, hey, you know, to use defunding the police, man, is really setting you off on a bad track to begin with. I get that.
You know what, Michael, if you don't mind, just hold on one second because we have that clip from President Obama. I want to give our audience a chance to hear that, and then we'll get your response to what the former president said. And this is President Obama speaking just a couple of days ago, discussing the backlash to the defund the police sloganies with Peter Hamby, an interview on a show called Good Luck America.
If you believe, as I do, that we should be able to reform the criminal justice system so that it's not biased and treats everybody fairly, I guess you can use a snappy slogan like defund the police, but you know you've lost a big audience the minute you say it, which makes it a lot less likely that you're actually going to get the changes you want done. But if you instead say, let's reform the police department so that everybody's being treated fairly, you know, divert young people from getting into crime. And if there's a homeless guy, can maybe we send a mental health worker there instead of an armed unit that could end up resulting in a tragedy? Suddenly, a whole bunch of folks who might not otherwise listen to you are listening to you. So the key is deciding, do you want to actually get something done, or do you want to feel good among the people you already agree with? And if you want to get something done in a democracy, in a country as big and diverse as ours, then you've got to be able to meet people where they are and play a game of addition and not subtraction.
I know from interviewing you so many times, Michael Eric Dyson, you care deeply about words and about language. So defund the police. What's your position on that?
Yeah, first of all, I want to congratulate you, Marty. Your journalistic pedigree is vouchsafed by your careful attention to detail. A lot of people played a couple sentences from Obama, and it's easy to dismiss them, go, you know, the left wing, which I understand, the left of which I'm a part, the progressives of which I'm a part, you know, were hammering Obama because they didn't listen to the whole interview, or at least that part of it. And thank you for playing the entire thing.
Sure.
In that light, Obama is far more reasonable, right? Because he's basically saying, do you want the commercial or the product? Right? You can look at the TV and look at the commercial and go, oh my God, that's great. We can get a Slinky. Okay, I'm showing my age here.
Oh, I know exactly what a Slinky is, but yeah, go ahead.
But you can't, but if you get the commercial, but you don't get the product, it doesn't come through Amazon to collapse ages, then darn it, all the commercials don't help you with the Slinky. Oh, but you can go somewhere and buy the Slinky without the commercial. So Obama's saying, do you want to do with people who already agree with you? Do you want to just hang out and show, hey, I look radical. Yeah, I said defund the police. Hey, I'm the superhero for the day. Or do you want to actually get the work done? So I understand what he's saying there. Even though, since he understands words and phrases, look at how your words might be used against the very people that ostensibly, supposedly, you might agree with. Although, let's be real, Obama doesn't want to abolish the police or defund them, but many people want to actually defund them. They don't want to simply reform police, as Obama said, to make it better, because that's been a problem. What we've done up to this point is try to reform the police. But Marty, let's be honest. The police unions are out of control. They have so much power that even when reform is suggested, the police unions push back on it. And as a result of that, you can have the attorney general, under Obama at least, issuing all the consent decrees possible, looking at strictly what goes on in these police departments and finding them wanting. But if there's not cooperation with the police departments as presently constructed, it's a hard row to hoe. So what we may need is defunding the police. Now, I agree. Words make a difference. And I'm not even on the left stuck or wedded to that term. I don't care if you call it Timbuktu. Let's make the reality of moving resources from police departments into other arenas of public safety. The police do not have a copyright on public safety. There are many other arenas within which public safety can be engaged. So that if you do have, as Obama suggested, trained therapists who might respond to Mr. Wallace there in Philadelphia.
Right, Walter Wallace Jr., right.
Right. Mr. Wallace, whose family didn't want the police coming for the very reason that they understood might be the likely tragic outcome that he would be killed, and he was. So there's no reform of that, because the reform has been suggested from time immemorial, it seems, and yet we haven't been able to do that. Maybe if we had a radical revisioning of the police or a radical reimagining of public safety, we would say, yeah, we still want you. We just don't want you doing all the stuff you're doing now. Do you know that 90% of the stuff police do is like taking kittens out of trees and responding to people on a normal basis? But here's the normal everyday basis. That's the problem. When the police show up with Walter Scott, oh, what's the wrong? Oh, he's got a left turn signal that's wrong. He ends up being murdered. Seven pieces of lead in his back. Sandra Bland, oh, it's just a regular traffic stop. What ends up happening? She gets brusquely treated, brutally arrested, and 2 days later, she is found hanging dead in her cell. Even the normal, ordinary, quotidian encounters between law enforcement and people of color often end up in tragedy. So we got to try something different. Do you know that in the 1850s, most white Americans did not want to hear or agree with abolition of slavery? Oh, this abolition of slavery, that's ridiculous. So maybe the abolition of the police seems as equally outrageous and radical, but in the long run, the ultimate goal is to find a way in which public safety does not end up being black people arrested unfairly and unjustly, but most especially end up being brutalized, killed, and otherwise disposed of in a way that most white Americans can never imagine or scarcely conjure in their worst nightmares.
Well, let's take another break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I want to pick up on a couple of things that you just said there, Michael Eric Dyson. And again, our guest is Michael Eric Dyson, and he's got a new book, Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. And we'll get some folks to join our conversation as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. Email us. Tweet us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine. What's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Michael Eric Dyson is our guest. We're talking about his new book, Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America, each chapter written to a black victim of violence, either at the hands of the police or at the hands of white supremacists. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Here's an email from Lee. Does policing represent the policies and mores of the state, county, the people, or the town in which a particular department exists, or just the people of the department? Why isn't policing in America uniform? Do you have an answer to that, Michael Eric Dyson?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we don't have uniform practices and policies. And excuse me, so it ranges so wildly. Some places are engaged with community policing. Some police departments insist that their police people live in the very regions that they police. Imagine that. As opposed to, say, coming from Delaware into Baltimore, where Freddie Gray ends up being killed. And what difference does that make? Well, if you're policing somebody that looks like your uncle or your cousin, you'll say, you know, you're a ne'er-do-well, but I'm not going to kill you. I understand it when you raise your voice. I understand it when you get irritated with me, and I'm not going to go to the nuclear option to contain you. So the wide variety of practices that are contingent upon local police departments without any uniformity, though they wear uniforms, seems to me something that we should pay strict attention to. But again, the militarization on the one hand of police departments in, say, Ferguson, and the tamping down on of it and say in L.A. Indicates to us that there's wide latitude and that we should be able to use, however, to bring some of these police departments under control.
A comment from Nancy says, I'm heartbroken about Elijah McClain. That's where we started our conversation. She said, I've watched the dash cam footage and I can't believe nothing is happening to the police involved. My understanding, and I'm not entirely up to speed on this, but I believe chokeholds in Aurora, Colorado have been disbanded or you know, considered that you don't do that anymore. And I believe the family is also suing the police department. Anything else you know?
Yeah, they are. But I think yesterday You know, there was argument, I guess, of the city, I stand to be corrected, against the wrongful death claim that the family has filed against that city. It is astonishing that nothing has yet happened. And yet it is sadly familiar for many Black people. Too many of us know that even when you got evidence, even when you've got empirical verification of misbehavior and wrongdoing by the cops, they are rarely held to account. Now, in this case, one of the cops that was involved directly with his death, was involved in some shenanigans of other police people who were taking pictures in a playful sense at the very site where Mr. McClain lost his life. They were making fun of it. This is just outrageous beyond belief.
Here's a comment from Margaret. She says, I must object to your guest singling out Jewish people among white people as those who need to be woke. Jews in America have always been prominent in the fight for civil rights and racial justice as people who know discrimination and hatred throughout history. Can you speak to that, Michael?
Where did I say Jews should be woke? I mean, Jews among other people should be woke. I don't think I even said that.
You did. I mean, you talked about white people and then you included I don't have the exact words there, but you included Jews in among white people being woke.
Right. But I'm talking about in terms of the Jewish people in terms of anti-Semitism against Jewish brothers and sisters, and saying that, you know, we thought that these things had, you know, gone much further than we thought, but lo and behold, it is true. So I wasn't suggesting that Jewish people among many others should be responsible for being awake. Having said that, let me use the opportunity to say that Jewish brothers and sisters have been among the most awake folk in this country. Think about the forging of connection and building a compact with Black people in the 1960s. Of course, there were schisms and internal divisions, and, you know, the adoption of certain, conservative viewpoints versus liberal viewpoints, arguments over affirmative action and the like. But Jewish brothers and sisters and Black brothers and sisters have been great allies and have forged an enormously important alliance that has withstood many problems, both from within and outside. But go back and listen to the tape. I don't think I said that.
Okay, fair enough. Obviously, focusing on police brutality, the police targeting or killing of Black Americans, and that's very important. But I think it also needs to be said in this city, other cities, the Black-on-Black crime is dramatically on the rise. These are Black people killing Black people, largely young Black men killing each other. In light of our conversation, Michael Eric Dyson, how are we supposed to understand this?
Yeah, I know what you mean, because those white kids in Columbine killed mostly white kids. And
is that what it is? That you kill who you know?
If you're gonna kill where you live. You kill who you know. 93% of Black people who die are killed by Black people. 84% of white people who die are killed by white people. That's a significant number, Marty. Why are we talking about white-on-white crime? Oh, my God, white people are going to hell in a handbasket. What are you going to do with the moral rot at the heart of white communities? Come on. The point is that, yes, it's neighbor-to-neighbor carnage. It is neighbor-to-neighbor violence. And the use of Black-on-Black crime as a canard is used most often to demonize the very people who need the relief from the suffering, because Black people have argued endlessly against how they are killed by their own kind in their own communities. But we really don't want to address that. White people are not interested in so-called Black-on-Black crime. You know why? Because in order to relieve it, they'd have to stop the economic immiseration, the poverty, the systemic injustice, the poor schooling. They'd have to talk about the ways in which the disinvestment in poor Black communities in Philadelphia is gone apace. And again, read James Peterson in Philadelphia Citizen on some of his recent articles where he's talking about the impact of coronavirus, but also paying attention to, along with Larry Platt, some of the economic downturn in the economy that has really hurt and harmed Black people. So white folk ain't really interested in Black people killing each other. And here's the difference between Black people doing, although I am heartbroken by the incident of Black people dying at the hands of other Black people. I don't mean to defend it. I'm saying that it happens in all communities. It is horrible. It has to be addressed, but the structural issues have to be addressed as well. And if we're serious about it, we have to pay attention to those realities. But we are not serious enough to engage that fundamental truth of what goes on in this nation. And until we do that, we're going to continue to have black people dying at the hands of black people, and white people who die at the hands of white people will in some senses be exempt from that horrible demonization that happens through the language.
You have mentioned cancel culture, and you write about cancel culture, something I've really wanted to talk about for some time. I'm going to quote one line from your chapter. The futility of cancel culture justice is that it wipes out the individual but leaves the system standing. What do you mean by that?
Well, look, if you get rid of the one person you want to cancel, like I'm going to cancel that person, if you don't cancel the reality from which they draw, if you don't cancel gender oppression, if you don't cancel racial oppression, if you don't cancel the systemic inequities that prevail in the culture, you're just replacing one face with another. You're not dealing with the undergirding realities, the underpinning of a particular racism or sexism or homophobia and the like. You're just removing one person, the next one will step right into place. This is what Edward Bonilla Silva talks about as racism without racists. It's a systematic perpetuation of inequality. So cancel culture to me looks like it's going after powerful people, though. Mm-hmm. Here's the logic of cancel culture. People who can't be got or gotten in, you know, criminal justice systems can be gotten on the internet. We can shame them. We can use the power of our voices there to amplify our disgust with what they are doing and getting away with it. So, okay, you might get a Harvey Weinstein. You might get a, Bill Cosby. You might get a R. Kelly. But most of cancel culture is directed against other figures who ain't that famous, who people we perceive to be powerful, even who are subject to it, you know, are deserving of a just day in court as well, right? The beautiful thing about, and the frustrating thing as well, about American justice system is that, you know, if you get charged with something, you can't just lynch somebody. Isn't this what black people are against? Hey, that Negro over there was looking at a white woman. Oh, let's have a court case to decide. Nope. We're going to grab the lynching rope, take him to the nearest tree, and lynch him up. The mob mentality is destructive, and this is a virtual mob. This is a digital mob, and black people, among others, maybe above all others, should be conscientious about resisting that impulse, because we have been victimized by it so often. And the attempt to adjudicate justice on the internet is so wrong-headed, because there's no assurance that today you are the canceller, tomorrow you will be the cancelee. And there is no balance. There is no, you said Marty did this. Can we have other people who would say Marty didn't do that? Is there any evidence? Is there empirical verification of it? Is there nuance? Is there not a difference between Harvey Weinstein and Aziz Ansari? Do we not recognize that if you have a bad date, you can't adjudicate it through Me Too? Me Too is critical. It's necessary. But Tarana Burke, right there in Philadelphia, did not have in mind some of the consequences that have attached to Me Too. She wanted to address the way in which black women who were being raped and very much exploited in black communities were not having their voices amplified. This thing is transmogrified into a kind of witch hunt of people who don't concede the legitimacy of certain norms and standards. That's racially too. I don't want to witch hunt black people. Hey, 20 years ago, did you use the N-word? Let me say one more thing. Governor of Virginia did blackface. Black people wanted to get rid of him. They decided better not to get rid of him. And what did he do? He did a whole bunch of stuff in office that was necessary and critical for the advancement of black people. Do not cancel people. Counsel them. Love them. Accept them. Hold them accountable. But understand that redemption is a real possibility.
And you were talking about the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, the pictures that came up when he was in blackface. I think he was in medical school or in law school at the time.
25 years ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. And he gave 10,000 people the right to vote as the governor of Virginia.
That's you.
On a related matter, you also say that LBJ did more for black people than Lincoln. Maybe, I don't know, more than Obama, I'm not sure. And we know in his private life he used the N-word. You know, he sounded really sort of horrifying, but you look at what he did as president and also as a leader in Congress.
Right.
I guess as an example of what you're talking about the dangers of cancel culture.
Absolutely. I mean, look, if Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today, he would be canceled. Let's just be real. Some of his personal flaws, his foibles. But the fact that he wasn't canceled means that millions of black people have not been canceled. And to me, cancel culture is white supremacy by other means.
Oh,
it is the attempt to eviscerate, to eradicate, to destroy. Black culture at its best has never been about destruction, about cancellation. I have had so many friends who have been subject to the vicious subjectivity and willful disregard for evidence that has ruined their careers, ruined their lives, put them on footing that is questionable because of the mob mentality and the will to extract immediate satisfaction over a supposedly just outcome that is neither just nor fair. And I think we have to really be careful about what we're doing and the road we're on right now.
A couple of other things I want to raise, and I'm trying to stop time. I'm staring at the clocks here. We only have a couple of more minutes. But you talk about IRAs, not individual retirement accounts, but individual reparations accounts. How would that work?
Right. Well, look, you ain't got to wait on the government to do something you know you have the will to do. People have written me, many white people, after reading my book, Tears We Cannot Stop, where I talked about that, A Sermon to White America. Hey, Dr. Dyson, I saw 20 kids in the local neighborhood who needed computers, and I fixed up a bunch of computers and took them over there. Beautiful. Individual reparations account. It's not mere charity, though charity is critical. It's not mere kindness, though kindness is amazing. It is the willful, it is the self-determined satisfaction and decision to make a difference in the lives of black or poor or indigenous people that you see, but especially in this case, black people. If you know kids who need to go to a camp during the summer and they don't have the means to pay for it, and you have the means to pay for it, by all means, if you are so inclined, do that. So there are many ways in which creatively white brothers and sisters, without the government's intent, although I want the government's intent, I want the government's participation, because white supremacy and slavery were a government project, so they need to be remedied in government assistance and government policies. But in the meantime, well-intending white brothers and sisters can make a huge difference. Who you hire, you know, some people, most of us hire people who look like us, smell like us, talk like us, think like us, right? Most people don't get jobs because they apply online. So change your practice, change your way, invite others into the fold who ordinarily wouldn't get a chance. There are so many ways in which that IRA can operate.
Are you optimistic about the future of America in 40 seconds or less?
Well, optimism, Reinhold Niebuhr, the great theologian, said, is a shallow virtue. Hope is much deeper. Hope. I'm not optimistic. That means putting your finger in the air and determining which way the wind is blowing. Hope is against the evidence. Regardless of what we see, we continue to believe that something will materialize. I am extremely hopeful because I believe and invest in a people who have produced time and time again because they believe in God, the universe, or the cosmic rule of order to finally right the wrongs that have occurred in this nation.
We have to leave it there. Michael Eric Dyson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Oh, you're very welcome. And again, his book is titled Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also leave a comment on our Facebook page, a conversation I started last night. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.